Today's passage is Genesis chapter 22, and we're going to do verses 1 through 19. And I will openly admit that this is a passage which troubles me for several reasons. I will leave you to ponder the potential ramifications and come up with your own conclusions, and maybe you can leave me a comment to educate me about some of the things that vex me. Of course, even though I have some problems with this passage, they are minor problems, and there are still some very valuable lessons in it. So, let's take a look at the passage, Genesis chapter 22. I will be reading from the NIV. And verse 1 says, "Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, 'Abraham.' 'Here I am,' he replied." Now let's stop there because I've already got a problem. God tested Abraham. Now, what exactly does that mean, tested? We could look at some different translations. And if we looked, for instance, at the King James, we would find that it says God tempted Abraham. Now that's funny. What does it mean to tempt someone? And would God be tempting someone? Well, we could look at the book of James, chapter 1, verse 13, which says very clearly, God doesn't tempt anyone. So then, if God doesn't tempt anyone, but he did tempt Abraham, well, we might have a problem. So let's look up the words and see what the original language said. Maybe this is just a problem in English. Well, if we look up the word in Hebrew from the book of Genesis, we're going to find that that word is nasa, which means to test or prove or assay or to tempt. And so it has sort of a wide variety of meanings. And I think, oh, well, surely this word means test, whereas the word in Greek means something different, more like tempt with sin. However, we find that the word which is used in James 1:13, that word incidentally is pyrazo, okay? Pyrazo, it means the same thing. And the same word in Greek is used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. So when Jesus and his followers would have read this passage in Greek, because that was the working language of the day, when they read this passage in Greek, they would have used this word perazo, and the same word was used by James to say that God never does that to anyone. So to make the point clear, the book of Genesis says that God perazoed Abraham, and then James said God doesn't perazo anyone. Well, that doesn't really clear anything up. We still have the exact same problem that we had before. The only conclusion that I can draw is that James must have meant something different by the word perazo than was meant in the book of Genesis. And there is just a subtle shade of meaning that we maybe have lost today, or that is difficult for us to immediately discern. I think it's fair that the NIV uses the word test instead of tempt, and that in translating it in James, it uses the word tempt instead of test. Maybe that's getting at the peculiarities of the words. But there's still some difficulty there, even if we are to say that one is testing and one is tempting. Because why would God need to test anyone? What does it mean for God to test someone? I mean, we've seen that the word is test as like assay. And assay meaning, of course, you would, for instance, take some gold and you would test its purity. Is this pure gold or is it not pure gold? And so we might say that God is testing Abraham's heart to see if he is pure or if he's not pure. So then, why would God need to do that? Doesn't God know people's hearts? Doesn't he know their destinies? Doesn't he know how they will respond to a certain test? From a Reformed perspective, believing in the doctrines of grace, that God already has a plan, that he's decided what will be ultimately in the end, it's fairly difficult to understand why God would do that. It's particularly troubling for the Reformed mindset. But this is even difficult for the Arminian. The Arminian believes that God knows what's going to come, that he can forecast the future. So why would God need to test anyone? I don't have a very good answer for that. Perhaps the intent is not so much to test Abraham as it is that Abraham is simply tested in the process of what God's doing. And we do know that God has a greater purpose in mind in this passage than to test Abraham. And we'll get to that when we talk about the test itself. But immediately, the first verse of this passage raises some considerations which give my mind a little bit of difficulty. And so perhaps you have some better answers for that and you can assure my mind. But let's get back to the passage, Genesis chapter 22, and we'll start at verse 2. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." Now wait 1 minute. This gives me even more difficulty that I didn't have before. The Bible tells us that God abhors human sacrifice, that such things never even enter his mind, that he would never want anyone to do such a thing. Now, at this point, there's no law written against it, but that doesn't mean that it's morally acceptable. It just means perhaps that Abraham can get away with doing it without being punished, but it confuses my mind that God would tell him to do such a thing which we know to be so horrible. Now, ultimately, and I'm going to spoil the ending for you, God's not going to make him sacrifice his son, but he does tell him to do it. Of course, we can see that there is a higher purpose to this, and we are going to get to the higher purpose. But it's a little difficult for me to swallow from my human perspective that God is ordering a human sacrifice. I suppose that there is a solution to all of this, to my discomfort. And that solution is that we are ultimately going to have to get comfortable recognizing that we can't know everything about the mind of God. God's ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. And there are some things about God and about life and about the scriptures that we may not ever know or fully understand. But those things should not keep us from having a relationship with God and from placing our full trust in him. We are limited, finite beings with limited, finite understanding. And we can never expect to know everything. So we should never expect to know everything about God, certainly. Let's not let that hold us back. Let's eagerly expect in faith that there are good answers to all of our questions, whether we possess those answers or not. And I find that the longer I live and the more I study, the fewer questions I have remaining. The questions I have remaining are just more difficult to solve. So then, verse 3, early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife, and the two of them went on together. What do you think was going through Abraham's mind? I think that this is a little bit difficult, isn't it? You see, God had promised Abraham, and had promised him repeatedly, that he would have offspring through Isaac. Enough offspring that they could not be numbered, that they would be like the stars of the heavens and the sand of the seashore. And now he is preparing to sacrifice Isaac. Is he doing this with the belief that God had lied to him? And if he had a belief that God had lied to him, why would he trust Isaac, or why would he trust God in sacrificing his only son Isaac? I mean, if I had determined that God was a liar, I would not kill my children for him. Now, of course, we won't determine that God is a liar. But this must have been vexing for Abraham, must it not have been? Believing that God is telling him to sacrifice his son, even though he's supposed to be the father of many children. How did this happen in Abraham's mind? What led him to go down this path? The answer is that he had great faith. He had a faith so deep that it goes beyond what we would expect. And the scriptures tell us what was going through Abraham's mind. In Hebrews chapter 11, verses 17 through 19, this, of course, is the famous Hall of Faith, they call it, which lists the great heroes of faith in the scriptures. And it tells us, by faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned, here's what was in Abraham's mind, Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so, in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. You see, Abraham knew that God was faithful, and he knew that God would give him offspring through Isaac. And he knew that if he killed Isaac, Isaac would rise again. What an incredible faith from this man. Let's continue with the story. Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father..." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Isaac, of course, is starting to get a little confused about what's going on here. Abraham obviously has not had the heart to tell him. Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham!" "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide," and to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." Evidently, the Hebrews had an expression which was akin to this situation. If you're in a bad situation and it looks like there's no way out, on the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. There is an obvious Christological connection in this story, meaning that it points us forward to the work of Christ. Now, obviously, we haven't gotten nearly that far yet. We're only in the first book of the Bible. We're only in Genesis. But this is foreshadowing. We have Isaac, the only son, just as Jesus will be God the Father's only begotten son. Both are to be offered as a sacrifice, and they both go up the mountain carrying their own wood for the sacrifice. Now, while Isaac ultimately did not die, the entire story is pinned on the hope of resurrection from the dead. And what do we see? We see that the lamb is offered as a sacrifice instead of the sinner. So then, this story, even for its few vexing problems, has an extremely important message. It foreshadows for us the coming of Christ through Isaac's line. It foreshadows for us a perfect human sacrifice for sins, which must be sought through an active faith, and which gives us hope of resurrection and eternal life. Let's not let the details bog us down from the important message here. The important message here is that Jesus came and died for your sins, and that even thousands of years before, the men of the Old Testament were looking forward to that same sacrifice in faith.
For those of you who might be listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.